Good morning. I'm Sam, and among other things, I'm an alcoholic. This time of morning is not my best time. So, I won't go through the ritual of telling you that I get nervous about talking in front of people because I'd be lying. I thoroughly enjoy it. I quit being nervous about talking to you folks when I quit lying to you. And as long as I don't worry about you finding out about something I say, then I don't have to be nervous about it. As long as I understand that the gravest misfortune that can happen to me while I'm standing up here talking to you is that I may make a damn fool out of myself. And accept the fact that I have done that a whole lot of times and it hadn't killed me yet. So I'm going to have a good time for the next few minutes and I'm going to enjoy myself. And if you don't want to, you can leave or take a nap. Or sit there and snipe, whichever suits you. Don't make any difference. We're all here because we couldn't make it anywhere else. And if you got some better place to go, go. If I had a better place to go, I'd go. They, among other things, to me means all of those minisyllable maladies that the wig picker said were wrong with me. And we hear a lot of talk now about poly drug abusers. Well, I had a poly insanities running. Back in 1959, there were 9 different psychiatrists figured out I was 7 different kinds of crazy. And the other 2 didn't think I was sane. They just didn't know what kind of crazy to call me. So it was a relief to me to find one word, alcoholic, that fit all those maladies. I could even spell that one. And so a lot of the misgivings and troubles that some I hear a lot of people talking about. I talk to a lot of different people or talk with or get talked at by a lot of people. And a whole lot of them have problems with labels and all this, that, and the other. And the term alcoholic always felt comfortable to me. It sounded a lot nicer than a lot of the other things I had been called. And a lot nicer than a whole lot of the things I had been guilty of. So I didn't have any trouble with the intellectual part of the program until I've been sober a long time and run into a lot of intellectuals. I didn't even know you're supposed to question the program. When I saw somebody that had what I wanted, I asked him, how do you do that? And he said, it's all in that book. And I didn't even know to question him. The only question I had was, what book? And he told me what book, and I tried to get him to tell me, you know, how to get one, and I said, how do I get one of them books? And he was very adroit at avoiding these umbilical cords that newcomers got in their hand, and he just asked me, so how did you get in the penitentiary? And, I understand that. And I had been in the psychiatric interviews and word association tests and all this, that, and the other, book library. That's simple. So I went down to the library in the penitentiary and stole me a book. And I stole the first 3 books I had. Tore them up. See, I wasn't always this easygoing, fat, hairy old man, as my wife called him, there was a time when I had a tendency to act out my hostilities. And if I ran across something in a book I didn't like, I'd either tear the whole book up or snatch that page out and flush it. I don't know if any of you have ever had the privilege of spending a whole lot of time in the penitentiary, but if you're crazy enough to keep in a single cell, you don't have to reach very far to flush something. There ain't a whole lot of room. But according to all the saints that I run into out here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did the whole thing wrong. I didn't do anything the way they said you're supposed to, and that I went to my first meeting in 1961, and I went for the wrong reason. I went to get a free cup of coffee. I've been coming ever since, been sober ever since, and been drinking that stinking coffee ever since. So, like as with most of the things in my life, the truly beautiful and wonderful things that have happened in my life, I went into them for ass-backward reasons. My motives were always way off. And somehow or another, this God that I work for is a humorous, loving God. He got the weirdest sense of humor in the world. And I just have a lot of fun with it. I meet people that have this terrible God they're afraid of. They're afraid God's going to zap them. And that always cracks me up, because it's the height of conceit to imagine that somehow we've wandered along and lived umpty-ump years too fast and too smart and too clever for God to find us, to hit us with that bolt of lightning. My whole feeling is, if God had been out to get me, he had me. He had me. I had done it to myself, and all the rescue work was done by God. I did the get me into a mess thing, and God did the rescue work. So I learned about H and I after having been sober a long time, at a meeting that H and I didn't sponsor. The general headquarters of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, everything's got a bureaucracy, and ours is central office in New York. And they frowned on the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting I came to the first time. It was at Vacaville. Some of you know what Vacaville is. It's the nut house of the prison system. It's the California medical facility located in the quaint little town of Vacaville, and it's the nut house of the prison system. When you're too crazy to be in any of them other penitentiaries, they send you to Vacaville. Now, I went there express. Straight from the county jail. I didn't have to go to another penitentiary and go crazy and get sent there. I went there straight away. I don't have any problem with that step where it says something can restore us to sanity. That was the only thing I had ever heard that promised me any kind of association with sanity. The very best those people had to say was that with proper medication under maximum security surroundings, we'll be able to function on a minimal level. Now, that was what all my very best doings had done. That was what I got to by doing it my way, doing the thing. And they didn't reckon with what's taking place right here, right now. They didn't reckon with what was happening here last night when Mac was talking. They didn't reckon with what was happening at breakfast this morning when we were sitting there with Keith and Art and Ann and the other gentleman that came up before and we talked. That thing, that magical thing, whatever it is that happens when two of us who are trying to find a common purpose in life get together or see each other across the room or see each other across the counters in the supermarket or wherever, that magical thing that happens, that if you have felt it, you know what I'm talking about. If you ain't felt it, I might as well be talking Chinese arithmetic. Because whatever that thing is, it makes about as much sense for me to try to explain it to someone who's never felt it as it would be trying to describe an orgasm to somebody that ain't ever had one. Now, the only people that are going to be offended by that are the ones that ain't had one. And if you want to get mad and get up and walk out, we'll applaud. See, I didn't start out wrong in life. I don't have any of the proper psychological excuses for being a screw up. I had one mama and one daddy. Mama was a woman then, she's a woman now, and she enjoyed being a woman. Daddy was a man and liked being a man and acted like one and did all them things. And last December we celebrated with them their 59th wedding anniversary. They have always liked each other. Didn't come from a broken home. Didn't come from poverty. Was never abused or misused or mistreated. I had to go crazy all by myself. I remember when I first started the school, seeing all that bunch of people that I didn't know. And they scared me, and I knew that I was going to have to do something about that, because I had already believed, and I don't know where I got this idea, and it don't matter. I know that I believed that to be afraid of anything made me a coward, and if I was a coward, I couldn't grow up to be a man. And from the time I can remember, that was what I wanted to be. I'm not sure if I had a clear idea what a man was supposed to be then. I know I haven't the vaguest notion today, but I knew I was going to have to do something about this being afraid of people in groups, in bunches. And so what I did was I got mad at them. I learned early that if you get mad enough, it covers up fear. That anger covers fear. Anger is stronger than fear. Anger keeps me from feeling afraid. And I read later on, when I was resting up in them state joints at you folks' expense, those of you who weren't locked up too, I learned, read in a psychology book, that they call that the flight or fight syndrome, that you learn to either turn the fear into anger and attack, or you let it roll and run from it, and all this, that, and the other. And it just occurred to me, I'm educated far beyond my capacity to understand. I don't know where the hell I was going with that, but I'm not going there now. But anyway, I hated them, therefore, and I didn't have to care about them and all of that stuff. For the purists, the real alcoholics, I had my first drink when I was around 14 or 15. I'm not sure what day it was. If I'd have known it was going to be important to you, I'd have wrote it down. But I remember what it did to me, and I remember how it made me feel, and I remember reassuring myself that I was always going to either have some of that stuff or know somebody that did. And because it always did the same thing. I'd get a couple of big mouthfuls of that stuff and swallow it, and it never did taste good. The first whiskey I ever drank was straight out of the still. And any of you ever drank any of that old wheat mash whiskey, it, the taste is just gag a maggot. It's awful. But oh, it's high octane, and it'll get you where you want to go quick. But what it did was it turned on the don't care switch. And then I didn't have to worry about telling you I didn't care, because I didn't. And people who truly don't care don't ever even mention caring, much less scream at the top of their voice, "I don't care." And when you hear somebody screaming, "I don't care," what they're really saying is, "I care so much, it's killing me." And that was what the don't care medicine did for me. That's what I refer to booze as today. That's what we talk about, Drew. Booze and drugs being today is don't care medicine. I didn't have any problems in school. I've always had a remarkable memory, and for some people's sorrow. But I never had any problem past. I used to wonder why people worried about studying. I didn't know that there were people that really had to study the past, that people had to read that stuff over and over and over and over again. I didn't read it till the night before. I learned early in school that what a school teacher wants to hear is play it back to them just exactly what they tell you. And the closer to verbatim you can get it, the higher the grade. And that's true today. If you can do it just like a tape recorder, you make A's. You paraphrase it a little, you're into the B and C level. If you do any individual thinking and got little enough sense to write it down, you're likely to flunk. I think I think the whole public school system is just an overrated, overpaid, stuffed up, high flown failure as a babysitting society. Just thought I'd throw that in there. I don't have a whole lot of opinions, but the one I do, I really have them. I played high school football 1 year, and my God's sense of humor is thus that I played high school football, and I won a football scholarship to Auburn University. At that time, it was the Alabama Polytechnic Institute. And when they revised all of the entrance standards, they had to change the name of it, because couldn't nobody spell all that. So they called it Auburn U, Auburn University. But now, I always thought it was ridiculous that happened, because I didn't have then and don't have today 1 ounce of sporting blood in my whole body. Don't talk that shit to me about it don't matter who wins or loses, because if it didn't matter who wins or loses, it wouldn't nobody keep score. Some of you thought about that, huh? We got a whole society today that generate and create encouraging losers. They got classes that teach you to be a good loser. I ain't never going to one of them classes. I firmly believe the only thing I can do wrong in any game is lose. And whatever you got to do to win, do it. Rationalize it, lie about it later. That's how I feel about it in here. I understand them golfers that go out there and lie about their score. I would. And if you checked on me, I'd have a careful explanation for why I did if you caught me. Might not think about it, but I would have. I'm digressing, as they say, which means I've lost my train of thought and don't know what the hell I'm going to say. But it's okay, because, you know, if you had any other place to be, you'd be there. And if I had anything else more important than this to do, I'd be there doing it. But, see, I just don't take all this heavy-duty stuff seriously, because I think that, you know, let me tell you everything I know for sure before I forget. Everything I know for sure can be said quickly. I know for absolute certain and positive that the steps and principles of this program work. Now, I know that. I know I love that blonde-headed woman sitting right over there. I know that for a fact. And I know my God loves me. Those are three things that I know for a fact. Anything else that I'm going to say to you have already said to you is subject to change at any given minute. And I'm going to tell you today the very best I know what's true. If at a later date I find out it's changed and it's really important to you, and you come ask me about it and remind me where I said it and what day it was and what time it was, I'll tell you what's changed. Well, I ain't really worried about that. Life and times and situations change fast for me. I used to couldn't stand kids. Now I got three grandkids that I'm absolutely nuts about. And I got a little 4-year-old granddaughter that she crawled up in my lap and laid her little old face against the side of my head and said, "Grandpa, I want so-and-so." She gets it just as soon as I can go find it. It seems absolutely perfect and right to me that if she wants it, she ought to have it. And I would never have believed that. I have some people today in my life whom I genuinely love and respect as friends. I never expected that to happen. Never had one in my whole lifetime prior to this program. Never had a friend. Never was interested enough in anybody to be a friend to them. All of these things come from going to that first funny meeting to get a free cup of coffee. Now, the guy that took me to that first meeting, as far as I know, he is still on death row waiting to decide for them politicians to decide what they're going to do with it. He wasn't on death row at the time. He worked his way up there from after he took me to the AA meeting. But it didn't seem to work for him, but it worked for me. Works for me today. See, I went to the penitentiary for killing a man. I wasn't one of them bicycle seat sniffers or fountain pen bandits or one of them kind of folks. I did an absolute no-no in the state of California. It's against the law to do that, and they get mad. I mean, they take it personal. And them police you ain't never seen before in your life yell at you and talk bad to you. But I was raised up around what euphemistically referred to today as violence all my life. I didn't even know it was violence. People disagreed, they fought. If you couldn't handle it with your fists, your feet, and your elbows, and your teeth, you got your stick or a rock. And if that didn't get it, you got a gun or a knife, something. And I didn't know there was anything wrong with that. See, I learned early along in the spear business that there wasn't anything really to be afraid of from any individual human being. I know this, if it's warm-blooded breathing walks upright, you can stop it. If it has to breathe, there's a way to stop it. The fear I had was one that if I went to talk to somebody and say, hey, if I'd gone to Angel and said, Angel, I'm scared, he's going to ask me what I'm afraid of. If he's concerned about it, he's going to say, what are you afraid of? Then I'd have to say, I don't know. It's just here. I don't know what it is. I just know that it frightens me, and I don't know what it is. And I was already way back then worried about being crazy. And after a while, I just enjoyed it. I didn't worry about it. But in the beginnings of insanity, we worry about it. If you're still worrying about being afraid, don't worry about it too much because you ain't there yet. Insane folks, I've mentioned this to somebody, and this is just what little thing to think about. I've been in a lot of nut houses, have talked to a lot of nuts, and I have never met anybody who was a patient in a nut house who thought he or she was crazy. Not one. They thought I was. And I thought they were. But I was sure I wasn't, and he or she was sure they weren't. See, nuts have no fear of being crazy. They just know everybody else is. And all this is pretty disjointed to you, probably. I wish you could see it from inside here. I made a decision about God when I was about 8 or 9 years old. I don't remember again what day it was, but I remember going over in that old Southern Baptist church. Somebody, Mac mentioned Southern Baptist last night, and I'll be constipated for a week. And I hear that term unexpectedly, and every sphincter just locks. But I'd been in there, and this preacher had been ranting and raving for about an hour, and you had to wear shoes on Sunday. And remember when you first started having to wear shoes, how they burned the bottom of your feet so bad, and I'm sitting, my feet's hurting, and this fool's up there ranting and raving and screaming and hollering about anything that feels good, tastes good, smells good, sounds good, is a sin, it's wicked, and you're going to hell for it. And he's just ranting and raving and screaming and hollering and carrying on for a whole hour. And after he got through, and he, you know, took up the collection twice, and prayed over us, and then took up collection again, turned us loose, and went outside, and I sat down on the doorstep and took off my shoes and tied the laces together and hung them over my shoulder and started walking back up toward the house, and it was a little old gravel road, and it was late springtime back there, and everything was pretty and green, and this was in Alabama, and everything was pretty and green and lush, and there was a big old thunderhead just over by the hills. It looked like it went clear on up into forever, you know. And I was looking, and the butterflies were doing what butterflies do, and it was just beautiful. And I'm walking along there and looking, and I'm looking at all of this stuff and seeing what was happening, and that old red dirt and them gravel and all them things moving. And what I realized was that I didn't know what God was, and I never was going to understand what God was. But whatever God is, it's bigger than what that jackass was talking in there. Now that's all I know about God today. Whatever it is bigger than anything we know. And beware. When folks tell you they understand God, watch out, because they just told you their first lie. And they're setting you up for another one. Like I say, I went to that first AA meeting in 1961. It was sometime in May, because I got my, let me show you something here. I knew this reading, I stuck this in my pocket. This here is an AA membership card right here. Yep, so this certifies that Samuel Hardy, card number 277, is a member in good standing of the California Medical Facility AA. And the date typed on the back of it in red letters is June 13, 1961. Now, they didn't give me that to guarantee my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used that to get out of the cell block on the night they had AA meetings. If I had that card, all they could do, they checked the number, and then they didn't have to call anybody and verify and all this, that, and the other. That's what that did. But I keep that, and I go back into them penitentiaries every now and then and drink some of that rotten coffee they make in there to remind myself, because life don't always go on my schedule, and things don't always work out the way I think they ought to. And there's a whole lot of people, well, I probably wouldn't get to a whole lot of them, but there's several who owe their lives to Alcoholics Anonymous that they never been to an AA meeting. Because if I hadn't been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous these years and learned what you folks have taught me, and they had done to me what they did, I would have killed them. So they owe their lives to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's as plain and simple and as honest as I know how to be about it. I got out of the penitentiary in 1968, and that was never supposed to have happened as far as they told me. And my understanding of it was I had a life parole. And I got off parole in 1971. I was still married to an old thing that I was married to before I went in there. I got married twice just because they thought it was a good idea. And I didn't have anything else to do that day. So, she had faithfully, she said, stayed married to me all them 9 years I was in penitentiary. And Al-Anon just loved that. And they can all identify with it so marvelously. Wouldn't it be great to have that sucker safely locked away where you knew where he was? and you know where he'd be every day of every hour. I probably shouldn't have said that, huh? I asked the parole officer when I first got out if it was all right for me to split, and he said, "Don't be a fool. If these people aren't sure, they want you to be out here anyway. Don't you do anything that's going to give any indication of any emotional turmoil." They just really didn't know what to do with you, and after about 2 years, I went to work for a tool company, and there was a guy I knew who gave me a job, and a very good job, and sort of backed me and saved my life, I guess. Don't guess, I know. But I had a good job, and I was started to work on the assembly line and wound up in the sales department, and went from there to division something just within 2 years. and I had the 14 western states, and I was just on the road all the time. Another thing about this God and his sense of humor is that one of the biggest fears I had when I found out they were going to let me out was driving a car on the freeway. I never had driven a car on the freeway. I didn't drive much when I was younger. I lost cars and I wrecked them, so I quit driving. And I lost one time. Never did find that sucker. And you want to see an insurance man get all upset when he comes out to ask you what happened to that car and tell him I lost it. Anyway, the day I got out of penitentiary, I had asked three separate members of the L.A. Institutional Committee who came in on the panels out there at Chino. I did my last few years down at Chino, and I asked three separate ones if they would come and get me and make sure I went to an AA meeting the night after I got out that day. And I figured the odds were if I asked three of them, one of them would show up. And it was God's sense of humor. They all three showed up in the same car. But the next day, I went to work and went over, and this boss said, okay. My then wife took me over there and said, okay, I got him. You go on about your business now. And he said, come on, we got to get you a driver's license. Now, I hadn't driven a car in 10 years. I wasn't too good a driver then. But went over to Culver City to the DMV and took the written test and passed it, took the driver's test and passed it, and the only comment the guy said was in little bitty straight up handwriting, creeped down real tight in the upper right hand corner of that page, was overly cautious. Seems like I can remember feeling, yeah, if you knew who you was riding with, you'd be cautious too. But anyway, passed the test, went back over to the office, and it was over in West L.A., and we pulled in, and he was driving a Cadillac, and there was three Ford LTDs that year parked there. He went in the office, came back out with it. He said, wait a minute right here. He went in and came back out with a set of keys, and he pitched me the set of keys, and he said, that yellow one down there is yours until you can get your own. Follow me. And he got in his car and drove off. And I got in that car and I followed him. And this was on a little street called Barry over in West L.A., which comes up onto Olympic, and went Barry to Olympic to Bundy to the Santa Monica Freeway, down the Santa Monica Freeway, into the Hollywood Freeway, into the Harbor Freeway, and onto the Hollywood Freeway, and off into Hollywood. And by this time, it's about 3:30 in the afternoon. And I never seen so many people going so many different directions in all my life. And I cannot tell you, I cannot put words to how terrified I was. I have been shot at and hit. I have been cut at and caught. It never scared me like that ride. But when we got there, I pulled up right behind him. And only my laundry man will ever know exactly how scared I was. But we pulled up, and he got out of the car, and I got out of the car, and I still had that please don't rain on me outfit that I had when I got out, that I got out of the penitentiary. And he said, we're going to get you some clothes. And he said, how you doing? I said, fine. And then pants was too baggy. I knew he couldn't see my kneecaps jumping in. He sort of grinned and he said, I had to find out real quick how much brass you had. So you'll do. And we went into this fancy men's clothiers that had their own tailors and all, and he told the guys to set him up an account and I'll back it. And I said, what can I order? And he said, you're going to need a couple of suits, sport coat, 3-4 pairs of trousers, shirt, socks, underwear, shoes, and a whole bit. And he said, fix him up. And I said, how am I going to pay for this? He said, well, you come in, you pay some on it every month. So I said, how long? And I never had a charge account. And he said, you only figure you pay it off in 90 days. And I said, am I going to make that kind of money? And he said, if you work for me, you are. And so I was making more money very quickly than I ever thought it possible to make without a gun. And I was going to AA and took that first trip up through San Diego, El Centro, Yuma, Tucson, Phoenix, Flagstaff. And Flagstaff was the first place I went to that I didn't go to an AA meeting the first night I was in town. And I called and found out it was in the sheriff's office. What I did usually when I got into town, I got stuff put away and I grabbed a telephone book and I found an AA number and I called and found out where there was a meeting before I sat down and filled out my reports. I found out where there was an AA meeting. And so I called and this guy told me that the meeting that night was in the sheriff's office or police station. I forget now which it was, but it was where all those people were. And I told God, I understand that I should go to this meeting. And if I was as much of a man as I think I ought to be, I would go to this AA meeting where these police are, but I ain't, and I ain't going. So I went to a movie that night. But that's the only, I guess that's about the only night on any of them trips, unless I was still traveling, I didn't go to an AA meeting. And 1970, I got permission from the parole officer to split from that woman. And long about in that time, I went to Bakersfield to a convention and met Ann, and it was lust at first sight. The way I remember it differently from the way she does, but we got, you know, my ego remembers things in my favor, so, and hers remembers things in her favor. I don't know, probably none of you have that problem, but I remember looking up, seeing her walk across that floor in that hospitality room up at Bakersfield, and I wanted what she had, and I went over to tell her about it. And I got the first adult response to it that I had run into. She smiled and said, thank you. And we started talking, and I don't know if this impresses you, but I'm still in awe of it. That's the first female I ever talked with in my whole life. She's the first female person I ever really communicated with in my whole lifetime. Now, I had talked at a bunch of women and had been talked at by a bunch of women. I never had talked with one. And I almost forgot what my primary purpose was. But we spent that day together, and we went to the dance and the dinner that night, and this scandalized West L.A. no end. Let me tell you, I've got a picture of her right there in my head right now. I remember the gown she had on. I remember what color fingernail polish she had on. Remember what color lipstick she had on? Remember she had that real deep tan, and that dress was cut from on down to here. And we was dancing and just rubbing bellies and having a marvelous time. And just having, oh, it was the first time in my life I was dancing and having a good time and not conscious of anything except this is fun. We are having a good time. And long about somewhere during that evening, I asked her, I said, woman, if you could do just exactly what you wanted to do with your life, what would you do? And she said, She hesitated a little bit, and she said, well, if I could, I'd like to work full-time with young addicts and alcoholics. And she told me about she'd been doing some of it down there on Venice Beach, that she'd been on physical disability from having pneumonia, and she'd been resting in the sun down there, and she got to working with these. That was when they just run them dope beans out of the Haight-Ashbury district out there, and they floated down to Venice. And I said, let's do it. And she said, what? I said, let's do it. And I believe this is verbatim. She said, you're crazy. And I said, hell, I already told you that. That ain't got nothing to do with what I'm talking about. And she thought about it a minute, and she said, well, okay. And that was October the 23rd, 1970. November the 7th, 1970, turnoff was born. And we've been going at it ever since. And it has been a trip. The dream that is now turnoff, that has caused a whole lot of people a whole lot of vexation, but has permitted and privileged a whole bunch of young people to come alive, began about the last year and a half or 2 years I was in the penitentiary. And I'm going to run this down in about 5 minutes. If I talk any longer than that, don't stick me with a knife, just pull my bitch leg. After about 4 years up at Vacaville, they sent me down to Chino, and then I kept going to the board every year, and they kept denying me a year. And then when they just run that out, they sent me back up to Vacaville on what they call the stress units, and it is aptly named. And the whole purpose of that unit, everything that you do from the minute you get there, is that they try their dead level best to push your buttons and see how you're going to act, to push every button you got. And a couple of guys up there, they didn't have, they had two meetings, two AA meetings we could get to, and some of us decided we wanted another one. And they had put another unit on up there since I'd been gone, and it was called the Intensive Treatment Center. And so we decided, some of them decided, and I heard about it, and we got it all involved in it. And so we went up and asked them for permission to start an AA meeting there in the ICC. Now, we just called it the Little Nut House Inside the Big Nut House. And everybody in that unit was either actively psychotic or immediately post-psychotic. They were either still out in orbit or just back on the pad. And so we went over there, and the first night they let us have the first floor mess hall. And we went over, and we went in, and they had left a little kid there. They must have missed him when they swept or something. But this little kid's laying there on the floor, and he's just in about a half fetal position. He ain't bothering nobody. He's about a half fetal position, and he's just laying there sort of slobbering down the side of his mouth. And I'm not all that much of a stranger in a nut house, so I just sat down beside him. I sat down on the floor beside him, introduced myself to him, told him what we was over there for, and asked him if he wanted to go to an AA meeting with us. And he blew a bubble, and I figured that meant yes. So I took it, and quickly we had two meetings going. We had the participation meeting on Saturday night, and then we had a step study meeting on Tuesday night. And every time I would go over there, it took the bull a little while to figure out I wasn't trying to punk this kid, so he let me go get it. And then after a month or so, 2 months, 3 months, went over there, and the bull said, I got a surprise for you. And I immediately jumped paranoid, because I wasn't too fond of them bulls and didn't like surprises. But this was a good one. The surprise was, this kid was ready that night, and he was all cleaned up. And he had his glasses cleaned off where he could see through them, and he had his hair combed, and them little two little three little kid whiskers he had was shaved off. He even had his shoes shine. and he had on clean blues. And ready, and he come walking up. Now this kid wasn't quite 17 years old. His brain was physically atrophied through chemical ingestion to the point where at not quite 17 years old, he was senile. He was a senile old man. The big word is precocious senility, chemically induced, and I know you're not impressed by that, but he come walking up, and he walked like a very old man, to make sure he got each foot planted firmly and flat down, and he walked up to me, and his head up like this, and took my arm, and he said, "Let's go sit down." And I always hunt the front row anyway. And so we come up and sit down like Tony's sitting there and Gloria's sitting there. I'm sitting where Tony's sitting. He's sitting where Gloria's sitting. And he looked up at me with them little watery blue eyes. And he said, "Sam, I love you." And I blew all my tough guy image. Tough guys don't sit in AA meetings in penitentiary and bawl like a big baby. But I sit there and bawl. And thought about what a marvelously loving God this is we work for. Because, see, God knows that when I'm in the midst of a miracle, I don't see it. So what he did was show me through this kid what those people had done for me. And he showed it to me in a way that I could understand it. And I made up my mind somewhere along the line that if they ever did slip up and let me out of the penitentiary. Now, Ann says that one of these days I'm going to have to quit saying this. I'm going to have to quit feeling this. It ain't got here yet. See, I believe in revenge like the Pope believes in Catholicism. Now, I believe in it clear down to my bottom of my feet. I don't do it because I don't want to go to the penitentiary. I'm willing to leave vengeance to God because I'm not willing to pay the price. It don't mean I don't want to do it. But I figure now, if I want to get even with these penitentiaries, first thing I do, if they ever let me out, I'm going to stay out. People keep going back in there and talking about they hate it. They're lying. Okay, let me out, I'm going to stay out. Maybe somewhere, somehow, somewhere along the way, I can figure out a way to beat them out of some customers. See? And that'll help. That'll put some icing on the cake. See, I would like to close the prison system through lack of customers. I don't want to change the prison system. I don't want to improve the prison system. I'd like to see them just run out of customers. And if we can get this love thing going, if enough of us believe, and if enough of us believe strongly enough to do, rather than sit on our respective asses and wait for somebody else to do it, maybe we can have an effect on it. I'm going to do my best. And I know those of you that are here for this H&I meeting, I know you're doing your best. The H&I people are the ones that are doing it. And but anyway, when I met Ann and that dream started, then it fell together, what we were going to do. Now, the dream was we were going to start out, and I was going to finance it. Ann was going to run it. We were going to find some loyal, true, blue, trustworthy AA guy to help her run the place. And all the loyal, trustworthy AA guys we found, they thought when they got there that being there gave them possessive privileges of the gals. And if you'll pardon my direct English, I got no respect for cripple fuckers, and I don't like them. And I heard a couple of them. And that... they looked down on me and disfavored some of them in West L.A. But the ones I hurt don't mess with nobody around me. And, anyway, I don't know where I got off on that. But
I guess it's because I sort of like to talk about it. I enjoyed it. They bounced nicely going down them stairs. But we've been doing this thing, seems like forever now. But on the way to Bakersfield, I was praying, and I pray just like I'm talking to you. I don't believe God's impressed by me going somewhere in a quiet place and getting on my knees and getting in a certain position. When I can do that, I'm doing that to remind me I'm not impressing God. And I don't really think I'm breaking any news to God when I get said what I'm saying. That's for my benefit. So I tell him, you know, I got the things that I'm supposed to have to make me comfortable. I got a back pocket full of credit cards. I got a front pocket full of money. I got tailor-made everything. I'm driving a brand new car, and I'm miserable. And I didn't get sober to be miserable. It talks about contented and useful living. It talks about happy, joyous, and free. I didn't get sober to be miserable. I got an earned PhD in misery, and I got it before I learned about this program. I'm doing postgraduate work now in how to learn how to live happy, joyous, and free. I don't believe there's any virtue in suffering. I don't believe there's any virtue in poverty. I don't believe there's any virtue in pity. When you come up to me with your sad, sad tale, and if you expect me to feel sorry for you, you're full of shit. I ain't got no pity for you or nobody else. What pity I got, I use it on me. I've got a disease, and the disease is three parts: self-pity, self-righteousness, and self-bullshit. You can doctor it up any way you want to. It sounds marvelous. An obsession of the mind combined with knowledge of the body. Isn't that something marvelous? I ain't working for no MD. Self, self, self. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that's what will kill me. Through you people, my God has talked to me and has saved my life. That's how I hear God, through you. Every one of you has a message for me from God. If I miss it, it's not your fault, it's my fault. One day, at least for 15 minutes before I die, I want to love as completely as I once hated. Because there was a time when I hated every living, breathing human being that walked. I get a kick out of these folks that hate little different groups. Well, that's chicken shit. If you can't hate them all, give it up. You just get confused. And I want to one day, for a little while. I'll settle for a minute. I'd like to have more. Well, one day, love as completely, as totally, as all-inclusively as I once hated. And I believe that will be the door opening, and I'll walk right on in and sit down in God's lap. Thank you.